This is Raja Molina on Creative Disturbance. I'm delighted to be here with Sharath Chandra Ram, and we are here in all places in the Explorer Park in Medellin, Colombia. So Sharath, tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do, and why you're here.
Hi, I'm basically an amateur radio operator ever since I was 18, and my interests lie in open science on one hand, and the other hand in internet policy research and the whole debate around internet freedoms and the networked economy.
And you're working in Bangalore at a very well-known school?
Yes, I teach at the Srishti Institute of Art, Design and Technology.
Uh-huh.
And
In Bangalore.
Yeah. And I maintain a lab at the Center for Internet and Society, in which we deal with the complicated issues related to the network society, and I have this great opportunity to actually take that legal policy research and then reframe it into pedagogy for art and design students.
So we're meeting here at a conference being organized here in the Explorer Park on communicating art with the public, and so we have a shared interest, I guess, in things that come from above the atmosphere. And one of the things you did here was you organized a workshop on open radio astronomy. So tell us about that a little bit.
Well, just a disclaimer that I'm not an astronomer.
Yes, no.
And I have an amateur fling, if you say, with anything that has to do with radio. And it was interesting while I was making antennas to tap into different parts of the radio's frequency spectrum. And I found that there were many frequencies actually reserved for scientists to perform radio telescopy. And there are a bunch of frequencies very close to the mobile phone spectrum, close to the Wi-Fi spectrum, close to your shortwave radio that we've all listened to the overseas news over the years, that actually have natural transmissions from celestial bodies or celestial events.
Well, let me just come back to how you started this. So, as you said, it's kind of weird, but people actually own the spectrum. And, you know, it's like someone owned the air or something, and you weren't allowed to breathe this molecule, but you were allowed to breathe that molecule. So explain a little bit about who owns the electromagnetic spectrum.
A good anecdote that I often share is how I got into radio in the first place. When I was 12, the kids in the neighborhood wouldn't let me play cricket with them. Now, cricket is the Indian version of baseball.
I play cricket, so
the kids never invited me to join their games. And once one day they were having a remote control car match.
Uh-huh.
Right, so one guy has to get this car out of the way,
etc.
And I remembered that one of those guys had a remote control car with the same frequency as the remote control car that I had.
Uh-huh.
And here I was from the window of my house, looking at these guys from the distance and completely jeopardizing their game.
Uh-huh.
So when this guy wants the car to go left, it starts going right. And that was like a starting point for my interest in the wireless spectrum. And the story isn't much different today. So there's a bunch of people wanting to use the same frequency in the electromagnetic spectrum, and only a few people are given the privileged license to use the spectrum. So this is always has been the constant war and the only and one of the constraints of wireless communication, because two people cannot use the frequency at the same time.
And which obviously makes sense if people are broadcasting radio or television stations. You don't want them all using the same frequency, and so at least you need to manage these.
Yes. So the way the frequency is being managed in most countries now is by the process of auctioning the spectrum. So there's a bunch of people say like, hey, I want to pay so much, and the mobile phone operator gets exclusive control over a chunk of a spectrum that he paid a government over auction. Now, research over the last 5 years have proven that this is an extremely inefficient way to manage the spectrum. And in a few years now, it's already happening in Mexico and hopefully Brazil soon, and a few states in the USA, where people access spectrum opportunistically. So it's opportunistic spectrum access, where there's a complicated machine learning system that can estimate which frequency is going to be free at any given point before you make a call on your mobile phone, and your mobile phone actually
just kind of first come first serve
just connects, hops, is able to hop across the spectrum, which is now in the dynamic spectrum allocation system. It's also called cognitive radio, not owned by mobile phone operators, but it's an open resource that
Very good. So now you're going to tell us how this connects with phishing.
Oh, this is a so phishing. This is an interesting art project. It turned out to be a sound art project that we did with the students of Srishti and the Kochi Biennale.
Yeah,
and it entails, of course, telling stories of the sea. Right, and sea being an interface of migration, etc. And at that time, there was, and even now, there is this sort of friction between the local fishing community and the sort of the corporate international trawlers who occupy the same seas that the local fishermen make their livelihood off. And I tapped into the naval maritime frequency, which is used for port control. And of course, you hear the million-dollar ships coming in from Dubai and where not into Kochi. The fishing trawlers making conversation with the port by pen. And then when the sea is free, then you'll see the local fishermen with their pirate radios using the frequency and communicating with each other, saying, this guy in this village owes me 200 rupees for the fish that I gave him yesterday. And it was quite amazing because here are two communities talking about sharing a natural resource. In this case, the fishes in the ocean, and how listening, and they also, of course, share the same radio frequency spectrum, and how through listening to the radio and archiving their conversations, one can then infer a little bit more about the livelihoods and the conditions that they are operating in.
And so what was the art project part of it?
Well, the art project was, of course, taking sounds of the harbor, stories of fishermen, stories of people who have migrated to Kochi over the years from different countries, and made a multi-channel sound installation with my collaborator Kathy Lane, from Professor of Sound from University of Arts London, and the soundscape itself was triggered by the locations of the ships in the real time, whose location you can actually get on the radio frequency.
Is some of that material available online? Or?
It should be, yes. Yeah, it's called The Beam Project. I'll share that with you.
So we'll give the listeners the URL.
I have a sound file.
Yeah. And so one of the things that you did yesterday was a workshop where we were trying to detect a satellite that was going overhead. So why don't you tell about that workshop and the other places you've done that workshop other than here in Colombia?
This was the NOAA weather satellite. Yep. NASA launched a series of them, actually. And the Russian M2 Meteor Satellite 2. Both of them have publicly accessible frequency downlinks, which previously was part of high science in like the climate science institutions, but then is actually quite not so difficult to make an antenna to first tap into those to the frequency by knowing the satellite pass time, which takes about 10 minutes. It passes over you in 10 minutes. And then it's about using baseband hardware and open source hardware over the last 3 years has made this technology extremely accessible to
art science
experimenters.
Yeah, it was surprising. So it was basically a bamboo frame with some coax cable. And
regular coax cable used by a TV.
Sheet of grounding sheet of cloth.
Bamboo sticks for the helical structure, cable TV coax, a baseband receiver, and a computer.
Where else have you done this workshop other than here?
This is actually the first time I'm doing a workshop here, apart from, of course, the students, my students back in the Art and Design Institute. But I also did took this interface now to the actual fishing communities
yeah.
on the west coast of India. And it was quite interesting to see. The context, of course, was how can weather data and weather imagery, which does not require the internet, can this be used within a community and for disaster awareness, for disaster prediction or mitigation, right? And it was quite interesting to see the response that they had towards satellite imagery. So many people had sort of difficulty in sort of locating themselves on a map, or like they see the clouds and they know they've seen this on TV maybe once in 2 days.
Yeah.
And it's a great opportunity actually for spatial education, spatial sciences.
That's part of what I've been calling making science intimate, bringing these things that are seem so distant into people's daily lives. We've got just a few minutes left. So we've been here in Medellin for a few days. We think we're going to come back in a year. Tell me what you detect here in the local community. You've spent an evening with amateur radio hams.
Yeah. So there seems to be like an underlying need, I feel, in most of the so-called hacker community
yeah.
and the technology community, and the amateur radio community has always been on the forefront of innovations
yeah,
in
yeah.
this field. And it seems there seems to be a need for more international exchange of knowledge and the feeling to be being part of a community that does stuff that matters and actually sees the light. And I think like radio amateurs are in a unique position, because the fact that they can transmit, this license has been given to them by the telecom ministry of the respective country,
yeah, yeah.
which means they are a good portal to actually draft technology plus policy and community work into a legal framework.
You also made the comment that in the group you were in, there were some very elderly people
yes.
as well as some very young people. And so it was very much an intergenerational
maker
group.
Very intergenerational. I must say that the true knowledge of making antennas and the analog circuits, which existed before we entered the digital era,
yeah.
still lies with the octogenarian
yeah.
community, and it's time that we actually extract as much of the knowledge that they have gained, and to make this to store, archive this, and share
anyway,
it.
So interesting. You mentioned that about the history of the switch from analog to digital. Well, one of the people that talked on Creative Disturbance was Dan Sandin, and he talked a lot about how there was kind of a resurgence of the analog at the moment, and indeed these kind of practices get you into pre-digital sort of
sure.
technologies.
I of course am of the opinion of not separating the analog or digital
yeah,
anymore
yeah.
because the methods of production
yeah.
do entail digital methods of production, even if you're making an analog component.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I prefer not to make a distinction between the digital and the virtual and sort of offline activities. And I feel it's really interesting how both these mediums, whether it's digital or analog or virtual and offline, can actually merge in a way that emergences happen, which are surprising.
Okay, very good. So we're going to have to wrap this up. So hopefully this will be the first of many conversations. If you or your students would like to publish some podcasts on the platform, we'd be delighted to do it. And as we just mentioned, we're now planning to come back to Colombia in June of 2017. ISEA will be in the town of Manizales, and there'll be things that we're going to try and do here in Medellin and maybe Bogota also. So thank you, Shrash.
Thanks a lot, Roger.
Okay. Goodbye.
Roger that.